Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, May 2nd, 2019. The wife of a deceased prominent South Sudan government critic speaks out.
The damage is already done. Even if we do what, it will not bring our loved ones back. So let the people in Juba accept reality and let's move on from there. It will even help us in this forgiveness and reconciliation.
And a man who was charged with treason in South Sudan reveals some damning information about the country's first vice president.
These messages refer to the Bonding guy, and I know, which has also been featuring on social media now, Dong did put out a message saying that he'd been warned by Thabong to be very, very, very careful in August 2016. So all this has come up, and it will continue coming up.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The wife of Agri Isbon Idri says she's still coming to terms with the news of his murder by members of the South Sudan National Security. Aya Warile says she has forgiven those who killed her husband, and she's urging the Kiir administration to stop denying the fact that it happened. Information Minister Michael Makui told local radio stations in Juba that the government of Kenya should be held responsible because Agri Idri and Dong Samuel disappeared in Kenya. Warile says, quote, "The damage is done," end of quote, adding that the government of South Sudan is to be held responsible.
I am belatedly mourning my husband. That's what I have now. I just want to give myself time.
I know that this news is not anything that someone will take lightly, but is there any steps that the family is going to take in order to hold those who did this to your husband?
As a family, we are still shocked, but I believe after some time, we'll sit and decide on what to do next. For now, it's not clear yet. We haven't consulted.
I remember when I spoke with you earlier this year in January in Nairobi, you were pointing fingers at senior government officials in South Sudan for being responsible for the disappearance of your husband. Is that still the case?
Now that they are confirmed dead, I've decided just to give myself time. I don't want to think about those people or the people who did that to them. I'm trying my best to forgive. Mr. God, forgiveness, I've forgiven them. And I'm praying that God helps me to forgive everybody involved in this. But I'm asking all the people concerned to make sure anybody involved in this should be held accountable, because I don't want this thing to happen to anybody, not even to the individuals who are responsible for my team.
This is a very difficult time that you are going through, and it's not time for me to ask you a lot of questions, but this has been a story that we have been pursuing for quite a long time. And if there is anything that you want to speak to the authorities in South Sudan at this moment, what would you want to tell them? President Kiir and those who are in power, what would you like to tell them?
There's no point of denying. Let's accept reality and then let's face it. It will even help us as family to heal. But denying is not helping. They had the chance to take them to court, but they chose this way. The damage is already done. Even if we do what, it will not bring our loved ones back. So let the people in Juba accept reality and let's move on from there. It will even help us in this forgiveness and reconciliation.
That's Aya Warile, widow of Agri Isbon Idri, the SPLM-IO official who was kidnapped in Nairobi and killed in Juba by the National Security in Luri village west of Juba town, according to a recent report by a UN panel of experts. She spoke with me from the Kenyan capital Nairobi earlier today. A retired South African colonel who was imprisoned and charged with treason and conspiracy, but pardoned by President Salva Kiir last year, says senior South Sudanese officials ordered the killings of Dong Samuel Luok and Agri Isbon Idri in January 2017. William John Enley says some South Sudanese national security officials told him that the first vice president, Taban Dengai, ordered the killings of Luok and Idri. Enley says he is willing to testify to international credited courts on what he knows about the two South Sudanese who were killed in Juba.
Well, John, as I said, I think last year in one of our previous interviews, I actually saw Agri Idri inside the Blue House on the day that he was brought in and on the same day that he was taken out. I never saw Dong Samuel. Dong Samuel was kept below on what I always call the criminal side of the Blue House Detention Center. But Dong was upstairs in Zangzan in room number 7, because I remember it pertinently. As you probably know, I'm busy writing a book, and I did manage to keep some notes. And one of the notes that I've added into the book that Audrey was in Zangzan number 7 in the top for the evening.
And so with your interaction with some of the officials of the national security, did they tell you where they were taken?
Not at that time, John, but afterwards I'm still in touch with people and people are in touch with us. And that is what the powers of that be don't seem to realize, that people are talking around them. They've not only spoken to me, they've spoken to many other people. They've given sworn statements. They've given interviews. I think at this point everybody wants to remain anonymous. But when it comes to trials, comes to international court cases, I don't think that that condition will remain, and they will be prepared to talk out. I've been sent WhatsApp messages, which I could give you the details of, that were sent to me a few months back, regarding our two friends.
Who sent these messages to you? I mean, you don't want to disclose your source, but what were they telling you?
The one guy who sent me a message actually works in the Blue House, and it was quite simple, and I'm going to read it to you. He said to me, "Those guys are no longer breathing. Very unfortunate. Taban behind their dismissal. Luri killed after 3 days. NSS, not MI, on 30 January 2017. Planned to kill James Gadet and to poison you as well, but the mission was refused. Taban has activities. He's not comfortable. Riok is a headache to him."
You are saying that they were killed on instructions of who? Who instructed their killings?
Well, according to these sources and other ones, the instruction from the political level, I know the report that came out last week refers to Akul as being in charge. He is the director of the Internal Security Bureau. But these messages refer to Taban Dengai. And I know, which has also been featuring on social media now, Dong did put out a message saying that he'd been warned by Taban to be very, very, very careful in August 2016. So all this has come up, and it will continue coming up.
Taban Dengai is the first vice president. Is this what you're telling me? That the messages you are getting are pointing fingers at the first vice president?
Yeah, I'm not pointing the fingers, so it's people within the organization that are, but logically it would make more sense. No one really knew these two gentlemen until this happened, and they were part of the SPLM in opposition. And why, out of all the people in Nairobi, why would they be selected or abducted?
Let's put this record straight here. These messages you are getting are from some people within the national security that were close to you.
Correct, correct. And they were working, and they still work inside the national security.
Someone would say, why are you talking about this now? Why didn't you talk about it when you were released?
John, we have been talking about this all the time. So I don't think I was in the position, and it was not my prerogative to explain to the families, to explain to the world what has happened. When a very credible body like the panel of experts from the United Nations confirms these facts, and their sources are not as limited as mine are. Mine are basically 2-3 people, even though some of them are very senior. Their sources are multiple. And I know they actually went into South Sudan, and they've been meeting people all over the world. So all their stories, all their facts have been corroborated before they submitted their report.
This national security training camp at Luri, who is in charge of it? I mean, the UN panel of experts says that the director of the national security was the one who gave the orders for their killing. But who is in charge of this facility in Luri?
Well, what I've been told at the time, it was Manuel Dal Moriel was the commander of the facility at that specific time. And I don't know him. So the name was given to me. His name is very complete. So obviously people know him well to have given his name here, which I'm sure can be corroborated or...
The panel of experts spoke to a lot of people about this issue. Were you one of them? Did you give any testimony?
I did. Yes, I did. Even though at that point it was confidential, etc., I was one. I did give testimony to them and to other bodies and other investigations that I don't want to mention now but are still ongoing.
How would you react to the government saying you are just saying this because they locked you up and you were caught without a visa in the country? How would you react to that?
John, if we go back to what the government says and what it's been saying, for many months my existence was denied. James Gadet's existence was denied. This is a very unfortunate, tragic incident that should never have happened. And the other concerning factor is, you know, why did the government, even up until, I think, 2 days ago when the Minister of Information said that, you know, these reports are unreliable, as he always says. But the bottom line is an international thorough investigation, and we must also realize the panel of experts are not a judicial investigation. Now, they did an objective observations of what happened. If we go into the detail, if they, as they put in their report, a commercial aeroplane was hired from Nairobi. So obviously there are flight plans, there are clearances to land in Juba, etc., etc. So all this will and can be verified.
That's William John Enley, a retired South African colonel who was in prison, charged with treason and conspiracy, and later pardoned by President Salva Kiir last year. He was speaking to me from Cape Town, South Africa, earlier today. Some residents of Yei River State are accusing both the government and rebels of the SPLM-IO of violating their rights. The commissioners of Mugwo County say they are working to address the issue. Daniel Friday Martin reports for VOA from Yei.
Mugwo County residents say, despite the signing of the September Rivatalas Peace Agreement, government and SPLIO forces continue to rape women and even kill villagers. Speaking in his native Kakwa language, county resident Moses Modi says soldiers also continue to loot citizens' property.
What is very painful to the people here is the issue of looting people's properties and cattle by the forces. We are not happy over this issue. We demand the government and the SPLIO forces to observe the rights of civilians, including free movement and access to our farmlands without fear.
Modi says fighters from both sides often pretend to conduct house-to-house security searches, but their real aim is to find valuable property. He says armed men later return at night to loot at gunpoint. Speaking in Kakwa, Betty Sandy David, a resident of Longamere village, says armed men are also sexually abusing women.
Our valuable house properties are being taken away from us. Rape and beating of women by the armed forces, and we are suffering. We are calling on the government and the SPLAIO to unite us in peace so that our children in the village can go to school to determine our own future.
Emmanuel Taban, a government-appointed commissioner for Mugwo County, says he ordered government forces in the area to protect civilians, not to abuse them.
We also agree as two partners to commit ourselves that to see our civilians are really enjoying the peace dividends. We can continue patrolling the roads in case if there's any person found in the road mistreating the civilians, and then he will be accounted, so that at least our civilians will really be free from any fear or panic.
Taban is urging people to report crimes committed against them. Brigadier General Isaac Lobare Samuel is the SPLAIO appointed commissioner for Mugwo County. He says he will discipline any SPLAIO soldier who violates a citizen's human rights.
We need to make sure that let our civilians move freely without oppression. In my side, I'm going to improve the security, both I and the commissioner, for government. So that we make sure that anything which is happen between me and him, so that it will be easier to be captured. Any military which attempt to loot a civilian, if captured, he must be put into book. And even our CDR last time came here in Panyume, he told all the army officers, what is called a civilian is really very important. Let us not mistreat civilians. And we are sure that we need to take care of our civilians.
Lobara insists that the government and the SPLA-IO are now working as partners to implement the peace deal. He accuses National Salvation Front rebels of mistreating civilians and looting their property. Chapter 2 of the River Talas peace agreement stipulates that both government and rebel soldiers must respect and protect civilians in areas under their control. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yay.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese civil society activists say the government has plenty of money to implement the peace deal. We'll bring details on that story right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how has technology impacted your life?
When I want information, I just pick my phone. I just go to Google, and all the information that I want, I get it just right where I stand.
It made me to be so social to people, like on Facebook. I've known so many people, knowing how they are going on in life, and also on WhatsApp, chatting with my friends.
It's educative to me as well, because if I need to know something about history, something about a disease, something about some medicine, I just go and read about it online.
When I need information, I don't necessarily have to go to the library. All I need to do is just pick up my tablet and I Google whatever I want to know about whilst in the comfort of my home.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Members of the South Sudan Civil Society Forum are calling on the government of South Sudan to allocate significant resources for implementation of the peace deal. The activists also warn the parties who signed the deal to restructure the National Pre-Transitional Committee, citing a lack of transparency in using funds to implement the deal. Onen Walter Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
In a joint statement released last night, members of the Civil Society Forum said South Sudan's political leaders have failed to fully implement provisions of the deal under the agreed-to timeline. The statement says the slow pace at which the parties are implementing the deal demonstrates a deliberate lack of commitment to deliver lasting peace to the South Sudanese people. Dorothy Drabuga, Executive Director for the Voice for Change, says the government has the resources it needs from the oil revenues and other sources to implement the deal.
It's like the government is asking for resources from outside, and yet we have a lot of resources within the country here of which we can start to implement some of the provisions of the River Talas Peace Agreement. Even the money we get from, for example, from immigration at the borders, but it's like the government is more relying on donors to support.
Civil society activists are also calling on the principals of the parties to restructure the National Pre-Transitional Committee, or NPTC, the body that oversees and coordinates implementation of the activities during the pre-transitional period. Drabuga says NPTC officials have done little to mobilize resources and international support for implementing the agreement.
There's a lot of malpractice going on within these members who are already in this NPTC. So that's why there is need to restructure again and maybe get people who are committed, who can do the work effectively.
Albino Akol Attack, spokesperson of the other political party, or OPP, accuses the NPTC of not achieving any tangible results within the 8-month period.
If you can evaluate what these people have been doing, you will get it nothing. It is zero. And if there was really no fun, they should have resigned or did anything. And if you go to the record, you will get their expenses are too high. For what reason that these people have been consuming this money? So we as OPP have even demanded the replacement of our representative there.
The forum also recommends that the parties and stakeholders extend the pre-transitional period to allow for the completion of security arrangements, internal boundaries of states, and the transitional constitutional amendment. Akol insists that extending the formation of the unity government violates the deal. He says a grace period of 45 days be added after May 12.
This is why the OPP says for us to commit ourselves to do what is remaining now, let us agree on 45 days. It is not an extension, but it is a period for us to be able to form the government, because the government cannot be formed in one day.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe and Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lumoro, both members of the NPTC, were not available for comment as they are in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, for the IGAD-sponsored meeting that was scheduled to discuss the status of the implementation of the peace deal and the way forward. For VOA News, I am Monen Walter Solomon in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Uganda, where authorities say where journalists say they will continue to report the news without fear of intimidation after Ugandan Communication Commission suspended 39 journalists at 13 different media houses. The commission reportedly accused the media houses of airing programs with extreme messages, including incitement of violence. Joyce Bagala, who is in charge of news and current affairs at Next Media Services, which owns NBS Television, says Next Media is assessing the communications claims.
We received the letter last evening, and our lawyers are still going through it. In the meantime, we are waiting for a meeting with the Uganda Communications Commission, because they made a directive that we should go there and have an interface and do some kind of explanation and give them some material that we could have used to air stories about Honorable Robert Chagulani, who is the Member of Parliament. They were saying that there was repeated breach of the minimum broadcasting standards that included, according to the claim in the letter, extremist messages inciting the public and misrepresentation of information, which are actually not true, according to myself as head of news. As someone who oversees the production of the news, it is not true that we put out extremist messages. It is not true that we incite the public, and it is not true that we misrepresent information.
And I was looking at some parts of the letter as quoted in this article. The commission is accusing you of broadcasting unbalanced and sensational messages or news. This has to do with, is that correct, as you mentioned, the treatment of Bobby Wine. How would you assess the coverage that you gave of that Bobby Wine's arrest?
We are balanced. The difference is that we are really bold, that we are balanced. Every time we have stories of that nature, we contact with the government spokesperson. We also contact the police. And in this case, in all the days that police are running battles with Honorable Chagulani, we have the police speak. So there's no way we are imbalanced. So the stories are really, really balanced.
This news is coming our day before International World Press Day. Talk to me in the context of the media in Uganda. What do you think is the state of the media?
Certainly, if you have been following social media in Uganda since yesterday, there's been a lot of concern, and the media, most of the media personalities, from the way they were expressing themselves, there seems to be some kind of fear, as if they're being intimidated. Probably that's what the government would like to do. But what I would say is that we are not intimidated at all. We will continue to do our work accurately in a balanced way. And on World Press Freedom Day, I'd like to call upon the government of Uganda to respect the freedom of speech and the media laws of the country and media freedom in Uganda.
I don't know, maybe you can clarify for our listeners, because those of us in the international media, sometimes we've had difficulty trying to reach the Ugandan government officials. Whenever there's a news story about Uganda, it's hard to get the officials to come quickly and respond to an event that has been reported. What is the experience of local Ugandan journalists?
Certainly, many government officials are very reluctant to respond where they need to defend government or make clarifications. But I'd like to say that the government spokesperson, who is Ofwono Opondo, is always ready and willing, and I'd like to give him credit, because most of the time that was needed him for a comment, for responses, for reactions, he's been readily available.
Thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's Joyce Bagala, who heads the news and current affairs programs at Next Media Services. She was speaking to my colleague James Batty. Tomorrow is World Press Freedom Day, set aside by the UN to honor journalists and their efforts to hold governments accountable and keep the public informed. This commemoration has special resonance with what is happening in Sudan, where protesters continue to press for an end to censorship. Justin Salad is the Middle East and North Africa Research Associate for the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York.
During Omar Bashir's time in power, Sudanese journalists were subject to all manner of different restrictions. A lot of it took the form of day-to-day harassment and censorship, whether they're state-aligned newspapers, independent newspapers, newspapers aligned with opposition parties that would try to cover something sensitive to the authorities, such as protests or rise in bread prices or ethnic conflict in different parts of the country.
So what did the government do to harass newspaper journalists?
The government would have a practice of pre- or post-publication censorship. That could mean intelligence agents go to the office of the printing press and say this article has to be pulled, or that could mean they prevent the newspapers from being distributed, or it could mean that they're actually confiscated from the points of sales.
Did Bashir's government actually arrest journalists outright?
Yes, this was especially true during the past few months, but also over the past couple of years too, as the economic situation in Sudan deteriorated, we definitely saw an uptick of the amount of detentions of journalists, the lengths of detentions, and the treatment of journalists in detention being subjected to torture, to ill treatment, to assault. We definitely saw quite a bit of it in the run-up to Omar Bashir's removal from power.
Can you give me a couple of examples?
One fairly significant case recently was that of Osman Mirghani, who was detained for more than a month. His family had told us that he was held in a cell with four other people in a jail in Khartoum known as the refrigerator because of the temperatures in which they deliberately hold the inmates. It's also a detention site known for torture and brutal treatment of journalists. That was kind of the serious escalation of a trend that we've seen since last year. We also, in 2018, documented the arrest and assault while in detention of Amal Habani, that she was physically beaten and tortured while in detention.
And you've said that this ill treatment actually escalated between December, when the protests really began, and April 11th, when Bashir was actually ousted.
Sure. In fact, from that period, we saw a lot more detentions of journalists. They were very hard to keep track of because the Sudanese authorities had a catch-and-release policy, essentially. They did this not only with journalists, but with activists and protesters as well. And at one point, they had to stop arresting people just because they were running out of room in their prisons.
Now that we've had at least a few weeks' track record, are you noticing any blossoming of free journalism there, or is it still kind of a wait and see?
From what we've been following, Sudanese journalists who are talking on social media, they're saying that people were able to print headlines that they may not have been previously able to. So there's certainly some promise and some optimism. There still very much is a state of flux in terms of the Sudanese leadership, and so it remains to be seen whether this will lead to an environment where press freedom can truly flourish. I mean, at the end of the day, people want their problems acknowledged. They want solutions, and part of that would be reflected in reporting on those problems in the press.
That was Justin Salad of the Committee to Protect Journalists speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. That's our show for this Thursday, and we'll leave you now with the song Yesu Nangai by Mike Kalambai. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles this evening. We invite you to tune in tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Oh,
tobika mituna benkitude nanga ezo abiano otatola